Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 19th, 2006. Today's session is entitled, The Wealth and Mystery of Width. The presenter is Fred Niedner. Session number NIF 2006-6. Let's listen in.
So, Burnett Quinton. In former days, as many of you know, it used to be called Tape Ministry. And they would sit across the hall and tape the sessions. Now, of course, we burn things straight onto CDs. And so you can't say, roll the tape, which was the bygone signal.
If you say that, you date yourself.
That's right. Then everyone knows you're a geezer.
Yeah.
In my case, it's not hard to tell. For quite a few reasons. But
I remember when you used to rap with your knuckles on the hood.
That's right. Oh, yeah. Is that how you started? Okay.
Yeah.
The hood was still here when I first started coming up. But, I'll tell you another reason the hood was valuable in a few minutes. Just a couple of introductions to myself and to the series before we get started, and a couple of notes of explanation about things this morning. My name is Fred Niedner. I come from Valparaiso, Indiana. I teach theology at Valparaiso University. Biblical studies is my area. And I've been there since the earth was cooling. And have now, in the last years, been teaching the children of my former students.
Wow.
And when the grandchildren come, I'm out of there. I have done Bible study at Holden quite a few times. It's a great joy to get to do this, and I'm very delighted to be able to be back doing it again. The theme for the week will be the theme verse for the summer, I am with you always, and we'll approach it from many angles. The short version is we're going to do a look at each one of the four New Testament Gospels. Starting tomorrow, we'll do Mark, and then Luke, and then Matthew, and then John on subsequent days, looking at how each of them has a theology of Christ's presence, the presence of the risen Christ, according to each of the Gospels. That's sort of the theme for the week. And so it's nothing complicated. Except that each one of the Gospels is complicated. A word of explanation about the context. How many of you were here last week? I'm repeating the same thing in a way. I did this for the work camp that concluded this weekend. Every morning during work camp, we broke for an hour. 20-some minutes of which was devoted to Bible study, except with 230 or so people gathered in the village center, we couldn't have discussion like we always have in this room, for those of you who are veterans of Holden Bible study. Unfortunately, the situation was I talked, they listened, and if they finished first, they let me know. And there wasn't any discussion. There wasn't any way to do that. So I just did the compact version of my study every morning. And this week we're going to have time to ask questions. And I kept saying, and probably until it annoyed people last week, when I would get to certain things, I would say, now, it would take an hour to unpack this, but we can't, so we'll move on. And this week, we're going to stop and do some of that unpacking of things. Since it was work week, I also felt I needed to pass on useful things to people. And I was told in another session that what theology and literary and other kinds of people, musicians, what we do isn't really very productive. It just sort of passes away in a moment. So I thought I would give you at least something to hang on to that would actually be a tool useful for the rest of your lives. I'm also in the habit of passing on things like this because you know that at Holden, hilarity is one of our core values. And hilarity doesn't just mean silliness. Actually, the Bible's word hilarity is the attitude of joy that people have given the opportunity to provide hospitality. It's the thrill you get out of service. That's what hilarity really is in the Bible. But in any case, here, we also think of hilarity in association with humor. So I always try to pass on a little bit of that at the beginning in case it doesn't happen naturally. During the session, at least we can say, well, we got that over with. We got the hilarity done. Now we can move on. So what I offer you, I gave to the work camp people who were somewhat concerned that having worked hard all morning and then coming in and sitting down and eating a brownie, they might fall asleep. So I said that was okay. I was used to that. I teach for a living. So it happens. People don't intend, there's a lot of things people don't intend to do. People don't intend to fall asleep in meetings, and people don't intend to hurt their loved ones. People don't intend to fall in love with people they're not supposed to. There's a lot of things that people do that they don't intend to do. But if you should ever be caught sleeping in a meeting or in a session of some kind, or this could even work for kids when your mother pokes you in church because you've fallen asleep, you can just raise up your head and say, oh, they told me at the blood bank this might happen. That's a good one. Or if, depending upon the kind of meeting it is, you can raise your head and say, oh, you shouldn't have disturbed me. I just about had the wording for our new mission statement. But in these kinds of circles, the most effective is simply to raise your head and say, in Jesus' name, amen. And what can they say? You've out-piaced them, and you win no matter what. We're going to play around in the Bible. I always like to help my students see that that's part of what the Bible is for playing around in. Yes, it's a canon of Scripture, and yes, it is a straight edge, and it's meant to measure things, and it's meant by the communities that gave us these two canons of the Hebrew Bible and the Christian Scriptures to keep things in line. I think we'll be able to see at a few points that this ancient literature was also in some ways part of the entertainment system in the ancient world. People told these old stories over and over again, not only for how deep they were, but in some cases for how delightful they were and how funny. And so we won't miss opportunities to play with things a little bit and to see what all might be there if you don't just read it straight. I just noticed a moment ago, however, that this is my little tube of glasses for people who can't see close up anymore.
No.
They're up on my desk in my room. And so if we do any Bible reading, some of you will have to do the reading, and I will listen because I can't see little print. But my notes are in 20-point type, which is the only way I can read notes anymore. I am with you always is our theme verse for the summer, and that's what we're talking about all summer and talking about this week. You know it, of course, as a line from the text in Matthew that's called the Great Commission, from the ending of Matthew's Gospel. And we'll be looking at it much more in detail on Thursday when we study Matthew, and we'll see just how complicated in some ways that little Great Commission passage is.
There is a large print edition.
There's a large print edition,
but it's not very large.
It's just about large enough to see.
Just about.
tell there's words there. This other one is like a impressionist painting of some kind at the moment. Anyway, we'll go some pretty wild places with Jesus as we go out on that great commission. We'll start just by picking apart the words of the little phrase itself. We may think we know what Jesus means quite easily when he says, "I am with you." The "I" part is simple enough. "I am with you." We know who that is. "I" in that little passage is Jesus, of course, but as we all know, when Jesus says, "I am," and in the Greek, that's ego, a me, if we have any sensitivity to the whole rest of the Bible, we know that we are hearing echoes of other Gospels. For, you know, Jesus in John's Gospel goes around all the time saying, "Ego, a me, I am this and I am that," and that's because, of course, that phrase got a certain use back in the book of Exodus in chapter 3 when poor Moses was trying to think through exactly how he was going to cope with the commissioning that he had just gotten, namely to go to Pharaoh and to tell Pharaoh, "Let my people go." And he knew what sort of difficulty he would have when he went to the palace because he was, among other things, a criminal on the run. And he didn't have much credibility in the palace. He also knew that when he went to explain this to the enslaved people that he was to lead out, that he was going to have a problem. He was to put it in modern terms, he was a suit. He had grown up in the palace, and these people had spent their lives as slaves, and now here comes this odd guy in a suit to tell them, "We're getting out of here. Come with me. God is going to deliver us." He knew that in both places they were going to say, "Oh yeah, who is this God?" So he puts that question to God. He said, "All right, so I'm supposed to get these people out of here. When I go to talk to them and explain the plan, who should I tell them sent me? What should I say when they say, 'Who is this God who sent me?'" And God, you know what God says? "I am who I am." That's what you tell them. "I am." And so imagine Moses going to the palace. And Pharaoh says, "Oh yeah, you're going to take these people out of here? Who is this God who sent you?" And Moses says exactly what he's authorized to say. "I am." I guess he had to be there. You know, he looks like an idiot. You know, like, "I'm the God? Oh, wait a minute." So there's a little bit of playfulness on God's part. And we'll talk later about why that's actually appropriate for Moses as well as God to be the "I am" that gets announced there to the Pharaoh as well as to the people. But when this Jesus fellow goes around saying, "I am," it's a kind of a, well, it's at least a theological claim that the readers of these Gospels understand. This is more in some ways than just another fellow from Nazareth. So "I am," we'll talk more about that, we'll play with it. "With you," there's a preposition and a pronoun. The pronoun is slightly easier, so we'll tackle that first. The "you," if you read the Holden News the last Holden News that came out had an essay by Paul Olson, who's the teaching staff coordinator, that unpacked some of this "I am with you" text for us. And the "you," of course, as he wrote there, is plural. So this isn't really a word to an individual so much as it's a word to a community. The premise obviously is for individuals as well, as we see, but it's originally addressed to the whole of the community of disciples as they go out on this journey to which Jesus sends them. I joke with the work camp people. Nowadays, at least in some circles, we would pronounce it use, or even use guys. I am with use guys to get it somehow into the plural, which we don't distinguish that well in the English language. But then with. I am with you. That sounds simple enough too. With and withness is a very elaborate part of Matthew's gospel. But let's just think about with, first of all, as an answer to a question. I am with you in the context of the Gospels is the answer to a question. It's not merely a promise, but it's an answer to a question that I think we can imagine easily enough the early church was asking, as well as all the outsiders that were trying to make sense of what the people in this little movement known as Luke tells us they were first known as the people who were a part of the way. They were the people who had followed the way of Jesus and taken him to be the Christ. And what they said was that this Jesus fellow, who everyone knew had been crucified, was also raised from the dead. And some had even seen him. And all kinds of people, both insiders and outsiders, had this question. Okay, friends, you say this Jesus that you proclaim is risen from the dead. Where is he? I'd like to see him too. It'd make it a lot easier to follow with you and to believe if I knew, where he was, so I could see him and understand this resurrection bit. And not only that, not only where is he, but what is he doing? Or as I'll put it later in the week, what's the risen Christ done for us lately? And the answer to the question, at least in Matthew, is I am with you. So what does it mean to talk about with? pardon me. I guess I should say as well, there's a deeper version of that question for the rest of the world, which we answer with the answer to our question, where is the risen Christ? The world doesn't initially ask, where is the risen Christ? Because the world doesn't immediately know about the risen Christ. But the world has another question that's closely related to it. And the question is simply, where is God? Even is there a God? And if there is a God, if this world is not just some vast, grand accident, where is God? How can we know God's presence? And in some ways, the most dramatic way that ever gets asked is in the course of situations that make God seem either the very idea of God a joke, or for those to whom that's not a joke, makes God seem very absent. And perhaps the most classic of all such ways of posing that question is grew out of the Holocaust in the middle of the previous century, as articulated by a lot of people. A lot of post-Holocaust writers have posed this question, and they have said that all theological language and all talk about God has really been rendered not just problematic, but broken. by the Holocaust. That old ways of talking about God just don't work anymore. But a particularly poignant way of asking it occurs in a book that I know many of you have read, Elie Wiesel's little book called Night, which is actually a memoir of the Holocaust by someone who lived through the concentration camps and who lost his family in the course of the Holocaust. And Elie Wiesel tells the story of how one night or one evening the entire camp that he was in had to witness the hanging of three people who had been at least accused and summarily judged guilty of participating in an act of sabotage. And they hung these three people in front of the whole camp, and one of them was a 13-year-old boy, and he was so small and light that the noose wouldn't work properly because it simply didn't pull tight thanks to his light weight. And so he twitched and hung there still alive for more than half an hour until he finally turned blue and succumbed. And as they watched this poor child hanging there between earth and sky, between life and death, Wiesel says someone behind him asked, "Where is God now?" And a voice inside him said, "There he is, hanging on that gallows." And of course what Wiesel meant was that in that moment the whole idea of God died. Whatever you want to say about God is over at that point. I mean, the question itself is broken. But as we'll see all week long, Wiesel's answer is our answer too. Where is God? For us, it's not a gallows, but a crucifixion scene, which is every bit as horrific as what Wiesel witnessed. And if you've ever researched what crucifixion was really like, it's worse in some ways even than what could possibly happen at a hanging. And we say, where is God? And our answer is, there, hanging on that awful means of execution. And what does it mean for us to say that? That God is with us in that scene. That's part of what we'll try to unpack. But with. With, in the phrase, "I am with you," suffers all the ambiguity that comes from trying to understand the trickiest part of any language, the prepositions. If you've ever learned another language besides the one you grew up with, you probably know how easy it is to make mistakes with the prepositions, more so than any other part of the language. I teach Hebrew, and I've learned a whole bunch of other languages that were required of people to go into seminary, and I remember how we used to learn the prepositions in lists so that we could remember whether they took the accusative or the dative or the genitive and all like that. And so you couldn't just easily translate. You had to sit there and go through these lists in your mind and then figure out how they worked. And even then, it was tricky to get them straight. I brought along a page of the dictionary, which is written in print too fine for me to read at the moment. But I remember what it says, and as I explained to the work camp, if you look in the Webster's Dictionary, you will find 12 different ways that English-speaking people use the word with. Somehow the Oxford Dictionary boils them down to 10. But let's just think about all the different ways that we use with, and this will give us a way to play with this sentence, I am with you, just a little bit. By the way, Hebrew has at least two and probably three prepositions for with, the biblical Hebrew. There's one that is im, which you all know, because it's the one that's in Immanuel, which is the Hebrew for God with us. Im means with. There's another one, eth, that means with. And then there's a thing that you can put on a word in Hebrew that's just a B sound, b, or if it's comes after certain other letters, it's pronounced b. Sometimes that means with, but it could also mean in, or it could also mean to, and so forth. In Greek, I am with you is with the preposition meta, which is one of at least a couple prepositions in Greek that mean with. Syn means with, as in synthesis and so forth. But meta means with, but meta means a whole lot of other things too. Meta means after, among other things. We speak, for example, of physics, and then we have metaphysics. That doesn't mean physics and then with physics. We have change of various kinds, and then we have metamorphosis. So meta is a really complicated thing too that we translate with, but we'll stick to English. If you look in the dictionary, it's interesting, the first meaning of the preposition with is against, as in something in opposite. And think about, I compare this with that. And what that means is we set them up against one another, and we look at them, and then we make a decision about what that juxtaposition means. We sort of have to put them together so that they're with each other, but then we compare them with each other, which really means we're putting them up against. So against is the first meaning. And so then we say things like in the Bible that Jacob was left alone and a man wrestled with him. That's pretty against kind of language, isn't it? I mean, it's the way we talk about fighting. And that's a common relationship for God and human beings in the Bible, fighting. God with us could mean God against us, God fighting with us, God having it out with us. And so maybe what this means is that we're in a struggle with God until the end of the age. Indeed, that's what the name Israel means. As many of you may know, this story, Jacob was left alone and fought all night, wrestled all night with someone. It's from that he gets the name Israel, which means, at least according to that etymology there in the Bible, that he's the one who struggles with God, and this is the people that struggles with God. And so it is for the rest of history that people mixed up with this God are strugglers with God, and against is as good a way to say it as any. I just noticed it's 9:30 and we're still on with. We better hurry. We also say, whoever is not with me is against me. So there's a different kind of with, which is the opposite of against. It's no wonder that it takes strangers to our language a while to get used to our prepositions. Prepositions are so sneaky because that's how we express relationships. And if you ever think about your relationships, how many of them do you really understand completely? So it's no wonder our prepositions are sneaky. With is a word of accompaniment. One of the themes for the week is come with me and be my love. John's Gospel. We like to say about someone, I'm with him, I'm with her. With is really loaded with all kinds of stuff there, as a word of accompaniment, as a word of relationship. My children in high school, my younger ones, this is just a natural piece of their vocabulary when they talk about their peers and who they're with these days. Oh, Liz is with her now, or with him now. You know, we know exactly what that means. It doesn't need unpacking, but it's code for a certain kind of relationship in high school. Moses used to talk with God face to face, as a man talks with his friend. We'll look at that a little more closely in a bit in Exodus 33. But we also say that we get angry with people. Like, this is an activity we do together. Come with me and let's be angry. We have joint activity. I'm angry with you. You know. Again, this is something we do with God. We have anger with God. We have all kinds of things with God. We also use with in an instrumental way. The line I used last week, I think, was Colonel Mustard did it in the ballroom with a candlestick. Mm-hmm. Did you play Clue?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there, it's how we identify something we used with which to accomplish something else. And I am with you could be translated that way. Because as God did with Moses, you know, God accomplished I am-ness on Pharaoh by means of Moses. And when he told Moses to go there to the Pharaoh and identify the God who sent him as I am, it was not only a joke played on Pharaoh, but God actually says to Moses in Exodus 3:7, behold, I make you as God to Pharaoh, and Aaron shall be your prophet. So Moses is going to play that role. And as much of God as Pharaoh is ever going to see is Moses, and with Aaron as his prophet to do the talking. So by means of Moses, God, I am's the empire, the Egyptian power. And God does that all over the place. God makes God's self known. God gets God's work done by means of flesh and blood. And so to say, I am with you is also instrumental. Well, we speak of those who are with it and those who aren't. We talk about going with the flow. Before I do the last one, which is kind of interesting and probably not one that we would easily come up with, are there any kinds of with that you're thinking of that we haven't touched on?
With child.
With child, yeah. That is the next one I'm... Because one of my favorite uses of with is from that text in Luke, only you have to read it in the King James. They've rubbed it out in the new translations that Joseph also went up from Galilee to be taxed with Mary. Not that with. There's another one. To be taxed with Mary, his espoused wife, being great with child. So with child we'll get to. But any others that you're thinking of there that we haven't touched on? Well, yeah, with you, as great with child, it almost sounds silly to think of Jesus talking about being pregnant with disciples. Behold, I am with you always. You know, like, oh my God, this is a pregnancy that lasts forever.
Thanks.
Yeah, that's actually a curse. You may know Jeremiah prayed a bitter prayer to God in chapter 20 of his book. You'll find it where he screamed at God's face, saying that he wished his mother had been his grave and she'd been pregnant forever, because his life as a prophet was such a miserable thing. But there's a sense in which this is a very interesting possibility for understanding what with means here. And to see how this might play out, we have to go back to the Greek and notice that the word order in the Greek is a little bit different than what we might expect. And I think I'm going to have to write on the board. I'm not going to write it in Greek, I'm going to write it in English. But the word order in Greek for I am with you always is I with you am. And I think there are a couple of reasons why this odd word order is used. This isn't a typical Greek word order for this expression either. It's an untypical word order. But I with you am allows us to play a little bit with the idea that that maybe we're talking something like pregnancy here and motherhood. The pregnancy idea appears in lots of places in the Bible as we get images of the mothering God. In fact, the many of you know the Hebrew word for compassion is a word that means literally to have a womb for someone. It's a plural form. When you say I have compassion for you, what you literally say is I have wounds for you in Hebrew. And the image, of course, is that you treat someone as though they were once a part of you. You treat them like a mother treats a child. You don't treat someone like they're someone you don't know or have any connection to. And if you all those of you who are parents know very well that this with-you-ness or withness that begins with pregnancy doesn't end with birth. It doesn't even end with the child leaving for somewhere else. You know, once you have conceived the child, they are with you always. Even if they don't come home. You can't not have them be a part of your rachamim, in Hebrew, your womb, your insides, your heart. And so it is, for example, that in this amazing poem of Hosea chapter 11, when the distraught mother God ponders what child Israel has done with all the apostasies of the 8th century in the days of days of Jeroboam and in the south, and all the various kings of the north of that period, God says in Hosea's poem, "When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. But the more I called them, the more they ran away from me, burning incense to idols and bowing down to all these other deities. I guess that they'll have to go back to Egypt, and the swords of enemies will have to rage through their cities. They didn't know that it was I who loved them, that it was I who taught them to walk. They didn't know that it was I who bent down to nurse them." The English Bibles all say fed, but the verb there is the verb for nursing. They didn't know that I was the one that held my cheek to their cheek, says the Hebrew. So I guess they'll have to be destroyed. What this is, by the way, this poem is written in the form of what's supposed to take place at the city gates, according to Deuteronomy 21. If you have a rebellious child and you have done your best to discipline that child and failed, and the child will not mind you or be a responsible person, you take that adolescent child to the city gates and explain your attempts to discipline the child, and you rehearse the child's rebellions, and if the elders at the city gates agree with you that it's a hopeless case, they are to stone the child and you are to assist, and the paragraph concludes, "And your eye shall have no pity, and so this evil shall be removed from Israel." So, there's a little text you could read on certain occasions. You know, it's sort of like the Hitler thing. You can only play it once in a big argument. But anyway, we don't know if they ever did that. For all we know, this was a threat even in ancient times only. But this is on the books. And this, Hosea 11, is written in the form of what you should do if you have a rebellious child. And so God, who's actually mother, God takes her child and says, "You know, I nursed this child, I taught this child to walk, I was faithful as anyone could be to this child, and look what they've done. Look at the way they've behaved." But then the poem takes a remarkable turn and says, finally, God says, upon thinking about the possibility of the stoning, and what God actually threatens is that the child must be treated like Admah and Zeboim, which were the suburbs of Sodom and Gomorrah, according to the book of Deuteronomy, that got stoned with the fire and brimstone along with those larger, better known cities. And so then God says in Hosea 11, the very thought of doing the Sodom and Gomorrah thing on you, what it says in English is, makes my heart recoil within me. And the verb there is the verb for what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah. And it's also a verb used in other places for what happens inside a woman when the baby won't come out. And that was a very dangerous thing in the ancient world because it meant the death of both the mother and the child, usually. You know that 70%, until the 17th century, 70% of the women who died during their childbearing years died in childbirth. That's how dangerous childbirth was. It wasn't just babies who got stuck, and it wasn't just all the things that accompanied that, but you know, if you're ripped badly enough, there being no antibiotics, you know, even if you didn't bleed to death, infection could so easily get you. This word for what happens to Sodom and Gomorrah is the word for what happens inside a woman when finally the baby gets stuck and they both die. And God says in Hosea 11, that's what happens in me at the thought of stoning you. My womb flames out, is what the Hebrew says next, after the Sodom and Gomorrah allusion. And so I won't do it. I am God and not a human, not a mortal. And so I will not come to destroy. I remain, and then in English we say, I remain the Holy One in your midst. So it's an I am with you text. I remain with you. But of course, here's the great irony, and makes this in some ways even more poignant. Hosea wrote this poem just a few years later, the northern kingdom was destroyed. The Assyrians came and destroyed the northern kingdom so that it never was the same again. They killed a third of the people, marched a third of them off to exile, and repopulated all kinds of other people from different parts of the empire with the third that was left. And so terrible, terrible devastation came upon this people, even though Hosea promised them, I am the Holy One in your midst. So if Hosea's word is faithful, God did not abandon Israel. God sat there amidst the stoning and held the child straight through it. I mean, unless we want to say Hosea was wrong and that God did not keep that promise, the only way God could have kept that promise with the people to whom Hosea spoke is if God sat there and took the stoning with them. So that's another kind of with that stems from the with of pregnancy. Once your child, always your child. Or at least that's how I choose to play around with the withness of that kind at this particular point. We got 10 minutes. We could stop for some questions or we can move on and do a little bit of stuff with Exodus 33, which the bulletin board says up on the kiosk that we're going to look at.
Sure.
Questions? Anybody?
Fred?
Yeah.
I have one.
Yeah.
I'm just asking about the deliberateness of I with you am, and I thought of... Jesus says, you feed the hungry, you visit the imprisoned, you care for the sick. Does that mean, without you, I am not?
If you play that out, if you play that kind of witness out and connect it, for example, to the thing that God does with Moses, I am by means of you.
Mm-hmm.
It also means that the rest of the world can know more profoundly or experience, they don't know what they're experiencing, but they experience more profoundly the absence of God than they'd have to because of the failure of those who have the opportunity to be God's presence. I mean, once you've got a people charged somehow with carrying witness, you know, their failures are as profound as their successes at making that witness happen. Which prompts me almost to launch into my little thing that I do with my students about the risk God takes by getting mixed up with a single people. Once God says, you are my agents of blessing in the world, and this is the last best hope for the world, the alternative is to go ahead and just let the flood happen and not not stop it. But I'm going to choose a people to work blessing in the earth instead of curse. You know, from that moment on, God and Israel are both stuck. Because if it doesn't work, the only alternative is curse. And God looks terrible. And then through the whole rest of the Bible, God has to keep rehabilitating God's own reputation. You know, we could go to Ezekiel here and talk about how God has to keep on rescuing God's holy name because the people keep sullying it by means of their behavior. So God has this problem. You know, God is stuck with this people to get witness accomplished in the world, but also Israel is nothing without God. Without God, Israel is just a little vulnerable people living at the mercy of all the bigger peoples around them. Witness, God's witness hangs by a fine thread at certain points because of what God chooses to create in terms of a relationship with a people. At least that's the way the biblical, part of the way the biblical tradition plays it out. I don't know, does that come close to talking about what you were...
Yeah, that was great. If it was a translation trick or if it was deliberate in what you...
Later in the week, I'll talk about a whole other reason why this word order is necessary for Matthew. But as I said, I'm playing. I'm playing with these texts and seeing what all we can do with these words. I'm not claiming that Matthew thought of all these things, and or Jesus, when he said these words, was implying all these things. But the way these words are presented to us in the literary text of the Gospels, they invite us to think of all sorts of things.
You didn't talk about am.
That's because it's not there.
Oh, it isn't? Okay.
Well, excuse me, it is. A me, I am. A go a me is I am. A me, I'm sorry. A me is the first person singular verb form of the verb to be. I'm sorry, yeah. What am I thinking? Yeah. You can, by the way, in Hebrew and in Greek, do a what's called a predicate nominative. You can just put two nouns together and it makes a sentence and you don't need the verb to be, which is what happens in the cup and bread words of the Lord's Supper and gets Bill Clinton off of we don't need to decide what is, it's not even there. And the verb to be, yeah, I didn't talk about that because there's not the am is just part of the I am.
It's sort of like when God says I am, he's saying something about himself or herself. What is he saying? I mean, I exist. I created. What is God saying?
The thing in Exodus 3
is an ontological statement of some kind.
Yeah. The thing in Exodus 3 is written about a lot, that I am who I am. Oh goodness. How much shall I say? You all know surely by now, because you've heard, if not anybody else, you've heard seminarians pronounce God's name in Hebrew. Yahweh is how we sometimes pronounce it. And there's great debate about what that name what that name is. And by the way, it is a name. The words for God are titles or sort of generic. The Adel is the generic Semitic word in lots of different languages for deity, God. God in the Hebrew Bible is often referred to with a plural form, Elohim. But this is a name. Yahweh is a name, like... I'm Fred, he's Yahweh. But it's only God's first name, God's middle name. We don't know God's last name. I'm just being silly now, but... the full form of the name is Yahweh Tzevaoth, which we used to allude to in the old form of the Te Deum. Those of you who grew up with older hymn books, Holy, Holy, Holy Lord God of Sabaoth, heaven and earth, and so on. Sabaoth is the Hebrew word for the hosts. Tzava is a host, and Sabaoth is plural, hosts. So Lord God of hosts is how that gets translated. This gets translated Lord for a very complicated reason, because we don't say this anymore. You don't say this word, because if you have an evil thought while speaking it, you could get zapped because of the commandment that says, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Don't do something silly or use it in a silly way. There is an old Jewish legend that the way Moses made that Hebrew slave master remember Moses killed the slave master, and that's how he got in trouble. The Jewish legend is that he snuck up next to the guy, because it doesn't say he had to dispose of the body. He just killed him. That he snuck up next to him and said, Yahweh, and the guy disappeared. That's how powerful the name is. So they said things like the name that makes the hair on the back of your neck stand on end, or the short version was to just say Adonai, which is a Hebrew word for Lord. Every time they got to this word, they would just say Adonai, which is why we say Lord instead of Yahweh, because you don't say that word. What does that word mean, Yahweh? This is way more complicated than we have time for. It's 2 minutes to ten. But the I am who I am formula in Genesis, in Exodus 3, is so clearly a play on the name of God, and does so by means of first person verb forms for the verb to be in Hebrew, that it's helped solidify the opinion of scholars that this word Yahweh is a verb form also of the verb to be, and that it's a causative form that means he who causes to be. So Yahweh is he who causes the hosts to be. Yahweh Tzevaoth, the full name of God, means he who causes the hosts to be. This is a theory about God's name. And when God says, I am who I am to Moses, God is simply playing with God's own name, with this verb form. And instead of saying, he who is, it's I who am. I am who I am. Well, it's 10 o'clock. We have to start drawing this to a close. We can take a couple questions. I didn't even get to Exodus 33, which I promised. So now I'm a liar.
On the verb am, I came in, I picked up the Santa Biblia just to see what difference there might be approaching it from a different direction. And the verb am in Exodus and in Matthew is a different verb. Yo soy. El que soy, and yo estoy con vosotros todos los días. But I'm not a good enough linguist to explain really the total difference between ser and estar, but ser is something that's more innate, continuing, irreplaceable part, and it's probably more a description of how you are at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'd be interesting to know why those choices were made in that translation.
Well, I think with Jesus, it's not Jesus saying who he is, but what he does.
Yeah. But still, I mean, that's still a choice of translation.
Yes.
By
points up the problem of putting them into translation.
Yeah, that's right. So there was somebody else.
For reasons of my own, I had the Bible open to Ezekiel 18. I'd like to share a couple of verses.
Ezekiel 18?
Yeah.
Okay.
23. This is in response to your stoning. Do I take any pleasure in the death of the wicked, declares the sovereign Lord? Rather, am I not pleased when they turn from their ways and live? And then moving down to 31, rid yourselves of all the offenses you have committed and get a new heart and a new spirit. Why will you die, O house of Israel? For I take no pleasure in the death of anyone, declares the sovereign Lord. Repent and live.
And you're juxtaposing that to...
Well, you were talking about the parents supposed to stone their son, and here's God saying, you know, the chapter is about righteousness and wickedness, but he's saying, you know, I don't take any pleasure when anyone dies, that he wants them to get a new heart and a new spirit.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that we could spend a week some time up here or anywhere else, just going through the Hebrew Bible, looking at all its different attitudes towards justice. and punishment and so forth. And that would be a prime kind of text to put in the mix. But we need to quit for now because we have coffee break and we have buses lining up and people to say goodbye to. And as always happens at Holden, we didn't get done what we thought we would, but there's always tomorrow. So thank you.
Thank you.